had the rage of a god in me. Like when I missed that turn, I was just like, swear word, no effing way did I just do that. I will get back. I will win. I lost my mind out there.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we're talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello and welcome back to the show. This week, one of the absolute rock stars of the gravel scene, Allie Tetrick. She's definitely on the Mount Rushmore as far as gravel racing goes. She was Queen of Kansas in 2017. Still has the course record, well under 12 hours for that 200-mile event. Pretty crazy. You'll hear us refer to the event formerly known as Dirty Kansas by its new name, Unbound, multiple times in this episode. That event was just recently renamed and rebranded. So if you're confused, that's its new name. Big thanks to Allie for coming on the show. I knew her pretty well, just from being in the same circles for a pretty good while now, but I definitely got to know her much better over the course of this hour. Along with a pretty diverse conversation, we also received a little celebrity shot question from her coach, Adam Pulford, someone that was my team manager for a couple of years back in the day and is now her coach. He just happened to call Allie to talk training at one point, and she apologized for the call coming through, and I said, no, take it. This is awesome. So Adam played along and provided a little question of his own mid-episode. So sort of something unusual and fun there. I feel like we should maybe do more of that, call-in questions. Big thanks to Zwift for being presenting partner of the Adventure Stash. We have lots of awesome things coming beyond just their incredible support of the show. We'll be rolling out some exciting partnerships and new things for y'all to partake in and join us for beginning in December. Until then, go check out Zwift. I was riding it yesterday. I just had an easy spin on the plan. And, you know, typically I look forward to easy spins because it means I'm pretty tired and that recovery day is very much appreciated. But Zwift is so good at motivating you and providing carrots to chase in a fun way that I accidentally ended up doing a pretty hard four and a half minute effort, because I was riding along, spinning along, minding my own business, and all of a sudden, something flashes on the screen that says, you're beginning a KOM segment, and today's record is 4.5 minutes, or whatever it was, and I was riding along, and just out of curiosity, one thing that's really cool on these little KOM segments within Zwift is that as you're riding, it gives you a real-time estimate of how long it's going to take you to finish a given segment, whether it's a sprint, whether it's a hill climb, whatever it is. And so I clicked a couple gears down, started pedaling a little harder just out of curiosity, and saw that I was kind of on pace to go the fastest of the day. I thought, oh no. So I kept doing it, started to get harder. And then by the time I was about halfway through and I was still on pace for record pace that day, I just couldn't help myself. Knuckled down and got myself that little polka dot jersey for the day. Never earned one of those. Zwift is quite competitive. And there you go. My easy spin day canceled. Thanks, Zwift. But in all seriousness, Zwift has so many fun ways to keep yourself motivated, keep yourself fit, whether it's partaking in the Zwift Academy, which started in October and runs all the way through November. That's a really cool all-inclusive program with group rides, training rides. It's basically just a virtual, or not virtual, it is a training camp that can be done from anywhere. Or if you just want to ride it day to day, like I've been doing the last couple of weeks, there's all kinds of other fun ways to stay engaged beyond just the general awesome graphics and feedback of Watopia or Yorkshire or wherever you decide to ride your bike that day. I highly recommend anyone and everyone go out and check out Zwift, regardless of your needs. I know once winter really hits here, I'm going to be relying on Zwift even more. Also, this week, another sponsor is back, Zip. This is a personal sponsor. It's a team sponsor of the Orange Seal Off-Road team, I should say. But they've also been great supporters of the podcast, and I'm really appreciative of that. They have some stuff coming. I can't talk about it quite yet. In another show or two, I'll be able to talk about it. But right now, before spilling those beans, I want to talk to you about a recent product launch, something I've really been enjoying using, and that's their Zip 303S wheels. These are pretty much do-anything wheels when it comes to drop bar bikes. Whether you're a gravel rider, a road cyclist, some of both, I use these wheels for all of my drop bar bikes. I've absolutely run them through the ringer on single track while riding my gravel bike on single track, smoked them on some square edge rocks when I take not very good lines now and then. No issues there. But on the other end of the spectrum, when I'm on my road bike, they are insanely fast. These are wheels that can do just about anything thanks to some pretty revolutionary design changes. One of the biggest ones being the hookless rim, which basically, it does a whole host of things. But quickly, one thing is it makes tubeless setups a lot easier to set up. I can get tires on and off with my bare hands, no tire levers necessary. And these wheels seal up tubeless really effectively and easily. And because of the rim tire interface, because there's no hook, there's this really nice clean flush interface between the tire and the rim, which makes these some of the fastest wheels in the world. The aerodynamics on them is crazy. It also makes it so that the wheel can be a lot lighter, and they're just able to be a lot more efficient with how they actually lay up these wheels from a carbon standpoint, from a resin standpoint, and that makes the wheels a lot more affordable too. So if you're looking for an all-around wheel, maybe it's something for your gravel bike, maybe it's something for your road bike, whatever your needs may be, I highly recommend this Zip 303S wheel. These are my workhorse wheel, but I also race on them too. Thank you, Zip, for being a supporter of the podcast and for making super badass products that I am so proud to represent and ride. Zip is all about making you faster. They've made me faster, and I know they'll make you faster too. Thank you all for listening.
We pressed 1,000 pounds of apples yesterday. And we're making another second time we've done it. And so we had pressed 2,000 pounds of apples in all. But yes, last night we pressed apples for apple cider. We're doing like a barrel-aged cider.
Holy cow.
Yeah. And my friend, I met her through bikes. And she has a super rad dairy ranch out here in Petaluma. And she sells all our pretty apples to the market. But the ugly apples she gave to me so we could cider.
Damn. So... This isn't part of your dad's ranch. This is separate operation.
Yeah. This is my friend. So super cool.
Wow. Since we already started talking about alcoholic beverages 30 seconds in, what is your favorite adult apple cider drink?
Like the brand?
Not like cider drink, but if you're making a mixed drink with apple cider.
Oh, I think favorite? With a little bourbon. Like we did a last year when we did the cider, we did a bourbon, like a fortified cider.
Yeah.
So you take it when it's a little sweeter before it gets like fully fermented, and then we added bourbon and put it in like big bottles. It was pretty good. Yeah.
Nice. What did y'all do for Halloween? Did it involve apple cider and bourbon?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, nice. Not even a costume.
No costumes. No, we rode 5 hours and then came home and went to bed. Yeah.
So what is that, like, your relationship with the bike during the pandemic? I assume it's had ebbs and flows, because at least for me, I sort of went through phases where I got optimistic that there would be something to do, some sort of event, something to chase, something to work for, and then that didn't happen, and then the full gravity of the situation, you know, came into focus, I don't know, May, June, something like that, and I sort of stopped hoping for one of our big events to come back online, and then I had to kind of refocus and create my own goals just to stay motivated on the bike. What is your
year been in that regard? Has it sort of had these ebbs and flows, or has it always just been sort of a low grade, like, oh, I like my bike, but it's different this year?
Yeah, I think I like riding a lot. That didn't change. I didn't need, honestly, everyone's like personal challenges when they all started them in May and June, you know, everyone was ever skiing or doing fastest known times and doing all this annoying things to me. Like, it, I know that would motivate some people, but it made me more stressed in a way. Huh. And I don't think, like, I didn't think that was good for everyone either, because, you know, you're dealing with the pandemic and then having this other challenge and not feeling good enough on your bike to add to that, or putting your body under physical stress. So I struggled with that. I didn't need to, but I did Rebecca's challenge. If I didn't Everest, I did, you know, the 17,000. And then I actually really had fun doing that, and I thought that was good. But yeah, then I was just kind of training, and I was having fun with my coach, because I've never been home in June or May, like in 12 years. So I was like, oh, the weather is really nice here. I live in a really pretty area. And I had a lot of fun just training, because I really like to train. So we were just like working on stuff that I don't normally work on. So like more of my weaknesses, I did some high cadence stuff, did some like crazy hard, like VO2 stuff, because I like longer efforts. And then I cracked. I think definitely by October 1st, I cracked. But in August, I was just like, I'm done. Like, no more working on weaknesses, no more training. And then I kind of got angry because still people are talking about next year, and I just couldn't even think about it and wrap my head around it. And we have plenty of time. So I really enjoyed it when the races actually just all got canceled for 2020. Like, that made me.
Honestly, no, that, I mean, that's a good point, because, you know, finally we sort of had clarity, because it was just this weird limbo phase for so long. I totally agree with that. Who coaches you? Is it Adam Pulford?
Yeah.
Nice. Adam is the man. How long have you been working with Adam?
A couple of years. Nice. I was working with Dean Golich, who Adam kind of worked under for several years. And when Dean moved to Red Bull full time, I just kind of like became Adam's little buddy. Like, I don't need a ton of coaching, really. I need more of like a therapist and somebody to talk me off a ledge. And then maybe a couple times a year, make me do something I don't want to do. But most of the time, I just need someone to tell me not to ride too long or to ride harder than I want to.
Yeah. You know, like, so your tendency is to just kind of do long, medium, easy base style rides?
Yeah. And I like doing longer, harder efforts, but maybe I only do one and not three of them, or, you know, I just don't, maybe won't like push my limit on some of my weaknesses. So usually it's just, no, you need to do that at 100 RPMs and I just want to vomit or something. I don't know.
So when you're getting ready for something like Kanza, how much structure, let's maybe go, I don't know, a month out, how much structure are you incorporating before Kanza, or is it all just general volume stuff?
I do quite a bit of structure, probably not into Kanza, now Unbound.
Right. Sorry. Ugh, I need to recalibrate on that. I was literally on those calls and I still can't remember.
I wasn't. I do quite a bit of structure usually into the first events of the year. And then it's, you know, with travel and, you know, things like that, it's a lot about just recovery and then coming back up. And a lot of my structure originally is based around my group ride. And so I have a really great group ride. I used to, haven't done that in a while, but 2 days a week. So if I can get kind of that top end leg speed 2 days a week, then I'm only looking at two other days of focused training. And then you add in a recovery day, a long endurance day, and then your week's pretty much set. So most of my training, I would say, starts in December and then builds into March, and then by March it's just pretty much, you know, events, group ride, repeat, kind of, and fine-tuned. But at that point, you know, we're traveling, say in a perfect year, we're going, you know, BWR to Grasshoppers, and so I can kind of pepper in events. And then last year I was planning to do more road racing, which is so weird because it's different than how I got into gravel. And then I was just thinking of ways to get kind of that top end without having to train, because I enjoy training, but I don't want a ton of focused things because I'm not trying to be a professional road cyclist anymore. So I want to just enjoy riding my bike and not be too stressed about it. So
Yeah. What is that? Is it the Roasters ride that you call your favorite group? Yeah. So you're in NorCal. I've gotten to do that group ride a couple of times. Give us a little idea of kind of the scene that you're in, because I think that's sort of been, it's an interesting topic of conversation this year, since most of us are so confined to home. And you're getting to, in a way, rediscover where you live. Almost everyone I've talked to who's in a position like ours, who travels a lot, says that. They're like, holy cow, it's so windy where I live in the spring. And I had no idea. So what has that been like, you know, sticking around your home area for the first time? And I mean, when did you start racing? Like, how long has it been since you actually stayed in one place for multiple months?
I started racing in 2009. So for sure, I've never been in Northern California in June or May. Yeah. You know, it's whether I'm racing the Amgen Tour of California, and then you head in July, or you're doing the Giro. I lived in Europe full-time for a couple years racing as well. So adding that in a domestic racing, it's just, I've never been home at this time, and it's just been really nice. But then also it's not to, not to say it's a bad thing, but you know, then also like the restaurants are closed and you still can't go and interact with your friends or family. And so initially I was being really careful, you know, to protect my mom, or, you know, who's like immunocompromised and things like that. So I got kind of angry about being home, loving it, but then also still feeling confined to not go see friends and families, you know, kiss the new babies and see my family. Like, that kind of bummed me out. Or go to the oyster place because it's closed.
Yeah. Has this year off strengthened the feeling that you have to have these big challenges, the travel, the, you know, the traveling circus in your life? Or has it made you feel, or made you think more, you know, okay, maybe at some point retirement from high level racing isn't going to be so scary?
Yeah, I actually would probably go to the second option. I felt guilty that I was enjoying the off time and seeing people, you know, I mean, social media is so hard because people are posting, you know, things. Some of it's real, some of it's, you know, maybe just a little bit of a guard, you know, up. Of course, it's social media, and, you know, saying that they miss going to events and miss the circus. And I felt very guilty being at home, having a really wonderful time, you know, spending time with my loved ones that were kind of close into my bubble and enjoying not traveling. You know, I haven't, you know, knock on wood, I haven't been sick this year. I'm not.
Yeah, like, that's true too. Isn't that crazy? I haven't been sick this year either. It's mind blowing.
Yeah. Like, I'm always sick like certain times of the year, and you know, it's travel, sinus, like international travel, you get a sinus infection, then you just then go race in the snow and you've got that thing for 6 weeks and doesn't go away. And yeah. So, I mean, I haven't been sick, and I think I've been more rested. And so I think my body really adapts to that in training from an athlete standpoint. But then I think now I'm officially trained out. Like, I texted Adam, like, I think it was like October 1st, and I'm just like, off season, done. Yeah. It's like, send me only your wine and bourbon. Don't.
I'm going to go press some apples, do some herding of cattle on my bike, and I'll let you know when I'm ready to ride again.
Yeah. I mean, I'm riding, but I just like, don't, I can't. I'm like, no. And I think I actually hit a limit, and that's the part I miss most about the racing or events, is pushing your body to that next level. And you just can't do that on your own doing hill repeats or something. Like, there's just no way. You need that competition, the leg speed, you know, those events to kind of keep pushing you up. And I miss that feeling of fatigue and soreness and like that. I don't do that to myself.
Yeah. In terms of just mileage totals and hours and all that sort of thing, have you ridden more this year or less overall?
I've actually ridden a little less because we're missing those kind of those huge events that course bump up your weeks, like the 200, 150 mile events. So I think my miles are a little less, because also when quarantine and like shelter in place first started happening, you know, I didn't want to go out and be super far and do long rides when I just didn't think it was safe or the right thing to do and add stress to first responders if I did crash or something happened. So I did much shorter routes for a while, just being cautious.
Yep, for sure. For sure. Okay. Well, speaking of super long races, eventually I want to get back to talking about Unbound and long events and who you are and what you're known for at this point. But first I kind of want to rewind, and a lot of people will know your career arc, but kind of rehash where you come from, how you got into that, and why you decided to step away from more, you know, traditional road racing to do this newer gravel scene. So maybe take us back. You mentioned 2009 is when you started racing. Maybe just paint us a picture of what your life was like in relation to the bike, say 10 years ago.
Yeah. I played collegiate tennis and I picked up cycling after graduation, did a little triathlon running into finding the bike. My grandfather, who passed away recently, was 85, like racing at 85. He lived in Evergreen, Colorado. He's out winning, you know, the Mount Evans Hill Climb and stuff in his age group. And he kind of was telling me I should take up cycling, which I thought was so dorky. And then, you know, all that tight clothing and things. And eventually I did. And I started just winning road races. And I think, you know, I couldn't clip in 2009. Like, that was my biggest stress, was like the pedals there. You put your foot, you flip in. And I mean, in 3 months I was racing in Europe, the USA national team, still worried about clipping in. So that was interesting, but the bike became a really beautiful thing to me. From a sports psychology standpoint, tennis is a beautiful sport and it requires a lot of experience and it's a skill sport. And I started it so late and I found it very frustrating being very naturally athletic, but so behind the ball and the experience and skill side of the sport that I knew I never could become one of the world's best tennis players because I didn't start young enough. And cycling and finding endurance sports that had this amazing direct relationship between the time you put on the bike and your performance level initially is so rewarding. You know, like, more time you ride, stronger you get, you know, until eventually you hit a plateau. And I found that so beautiful about the sport. And I could do, like, I was not like the prettiest road racer or cyclist, you know, I just mashed on pedals, went faster, you know, as a time trial specialist. And so just having that power to go faster and just kind of grit your teeth and go on. Hence, I don't ride mountain bikes, the skill side of things, but I just crashed on my first mountain bike ride. So I'm a little different than you on that. But the bike has really evolved into so much of just expressing myself throughout the years and kind of hiding my crazy, you know, using it as a therapy device and tool, of course, to get out the energy. And it became a really wonderful thing with my grandfather, who was a pretty gruff, serious guy. He loved me a lot, but it took him a long time to tell me. You know, well into my adult life until he would tell me he loved me. But the bike was this amazing language of love we had to each other with each other. And then I've learned now for a while, like through a lot of bad injuries and setbacks, that, you know, sports are life, and you find that life balance too. And so I don't want to be only defined as a cyclist, but I also think that cycling is going to be in my life forever. And it's just like a part of who I am. So, you know, fast forward racing then, you know, I had a really bad crash in 2010. So a traumatic brain injury, broken pelvis, like life flighted out of Cascade Cycling Classic in Oregon. And
what happened during that crash?
It was a descent and we just come back from winning the Giro, the national team. And so I'm feeling pretty confident, maybe a little cocky, but I wasn't doing anything. You know, I'm just like sitting third overall, like, God, man, this is my time to shine. And we're descending down, going about 45 miles an hour, because bend descents are real straight and not technical and fast. So, and there's an overlap wheel in front of me, and I just like am moving over. I'm like, okay, I can get around it. You know, I see the crash, and then somebody right to my side just, you know, people do this on the road, but it's their initial reaction is to grab a fistful of brakes when you see a crash. Like, it's your, so she does that and just front wheel. And so I went like zero, you know, 45 to zero. And I think the worst part is I didn't slide. So it was just the impact. And sliding is good because it's dissipating, the heat's dissipating and all of that. So you get bloody, but no blood. So just shattered pelvis, and then unconscious with seizures for 24 hours after that. And then it was just a really hard recovery process from then on. But typical cyclist, right? You or athlete, you come back really fast and you're very motivated. So as soon as I could walk again, I could get, you know, on the trainer, and I came back in 2011. I was really fast, probably one of my fastest years I've had in my career.
You had no misgivings about going back to that road racing scene, even after that crash?
Oh, I was terrified, a terrified road racer before that. And after, I would have straight up panic attacks, like while descending, or, you know, and I think I shouldn't have probably come back. I mean, now we can say that, but I'm back and I'm a different person for it. But maybe at the time I shouldn't have done that. This also was, it makes me feel old, but it was a little bit before people really started to talk about head injuries and concussions. And so with a broken pelvis and I couldn't walk literally for 6 weeks, I was totally bedridden, that you focus on the bone healing so you can get on and pedal your bike versus anything else. And then also when you're under that so much pain meds, you know, you're not diagnosing your own head injury at that time. And it just wasn't a popular topic at the moment. And then by the time I crashed again in 2011, and it was a fluky crash at the Pan American Games, I just kind of endoed on my TT bike warming up. And, but that with that concussion on top of the TBI, then that's what made it like total lights out for 2011 and 12. Like I had to learn how to read again. Mental health was just like toast, you know, I was racing on antidepressants and just trying to figure it out. And at that moment, I don't regret coming back, but that's where I really had to work on my identity as a cyclist or a professional athlete, and to realize that I have to always choose my health over results, and to keep investing in myself off the bike. I've always maintained a career off the bike, but to really make sure I'm okay with that, and maybe that is making you not as good of a cyclist as you could be, but to be a friend, a daughter, you know. I have a biochemistry background and I work in biotech, you know, like, so I'm so much more than just an athlete. And I think that was a really important transition for me. And it's, you know, I deal with the brain injury and the recovery today still. I mean, yeah, I'm like, I'm still a terrified cyclist, but also I had a very healthy dose of gravity, you know, healthy dose of respect for gravity. And I don't want to crash or put myself at risk.
What are you still dealing with today, symptoms-wise?
I think definitely like a little like the moodiness and, you know, some of just the, you know, which we all do, some mental health things. So just on little dark days, or I'm better at learning how to snap out of it or just be recognized and give myself grace when I'm there. And I think it also helps to communicate that with my family or my partner. Be like, hey, going through that thing, you know, that thing I go through, I'm there. And so, you know, they give me grace and I give myself grace through that. So I'm really bad with loud noises. So like a Harley Davidson rally goes down the street, or even worse, those streetcars, you know, like something like a Lamborghini or something like that. It kind of gives me a little bit of vertigo. I get nauseous. My ears ring. I call it flooding. Like you feel like somebody's turning on a faucet in your head and it's getting higher above your ears. So movies that are super bright and flashy, I have a hard time with, like action movies. I just close my eyes and close my ears. I'm a good date to a movie.
Earlier you just quickly kind of mentioned, I don't know if it was joking or what, but you said the bike has kind of helped you hide your crazy. Mm-hmm. Is that related to this head injury? Is that what you were referring to or something else?
Oh yeah. For sure. But like, I have a lot of, I call myself like a laser focused pinball. Like I can really focus, but I'm also like, bing, 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 bing. So sometimes just getting the bike and getting a little energy out, or, you know, like you get on the bike, you can solve world problems, you know, you can plan your next podcast, what thing you're going to write. So I do a lot of that just to get my focus, because I can't sit behind a computer all day. And I also, one of the symptoms, I think I used to be able to focus much longer. Speaking of that, Pulford just called me.
Sorry, did you just say Pulford just called?
Yeah.
Okay. You should totally call him back and we should patch him in real quick.
Okay. How do I do that?
Just like put him, just call him back and put him on speakerphone and tell him you're in the middle of a podcast.
I know, I haven't talked to him in a few weeks. Literally sent me a photo of wine.
So for those that don't know, we're talking about Adam Pulford, who was my team manager for 2 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Adam, you're on speakerphone. I was recording a podcast with Payson, so now you're on speakerphone on the podcast.
Well, that's wonderful. Will my voicemail make it on the podcast too? Or?
We'll play your voicemail in a second. I guess he was leaving the most amazing voicemail.
Oh, really? Adam, can you deliver live what you are leaving on the voicemail for us?
I don't know. It was something about, well, since you wouldn't call me, I guess I'll have to call you. And by the way, too many VO2 workouts, so we got to show. I mean, it was much better on voicemail. So.
Well, sorry to put you on the spot, Adam, but when Allie mentioned who was calling, I just couldn't resist this. So I'm going to super put you on the spot and ask you, do you have one question that you would like to ask celebrity shot wise of Allie for this podcast? We're about halfway through.
This is one question. Okay. My one question, Allison, is, Do you actually ride horses on a regular basis, or is it just all for Instagram?
Whoa, that is a savage celebrity shot question, because we definitely already talked about the fakeness of social media earlier in this episode. So very timely, very relevant. This is how we do on the Adventure Stash podcast. So Adam, thank you so much for adding richness. And Allie, you there you have it. You have to answer honestly.
No, I don't ride horses all the time. I wear cowboy boots a lot, though.
You used to ride horses a lot. You used to do other Northern California horse things a lot. So
yeah,
I did know that.
Yeah,
I think it still is very relevant, though, because Allie and I haven't talked about this yet, but I come from a ranching background too. My entire dad's side of the family are Texas ranchers for generations, and I don't ride horses very often, but I like to think that heritage is something that I can kind of lean into and take inspiration from, and a little bit of that, you know, blue collar hardworking background might carry over to bike racing a little bit. And I guarantee you Allie still rides horses more often than I do and is around cows more often than I am, so it's pretty sweet.
You guys definitely had a way cooler upbringing than I did. Horse riding, I was not good at it.
It explains a lot. It explains a lot.
Yeah, it does.
Anyway, Adam, if you...
Yeah.
Adam, if you have any other questions that come to mind, you're kind of on a roll, so feel free. We're happy to keep you on as long as you want, but...
Yeah, that's probably... It's the end button right now.
Yeah, that was awesome. Too much.
See you guys.
Right, bye.
Bye.
Now I wonder what his voicemail was. Yeah, if you want to fly on the wall with Adam and I, it's funny. I'll be like, how much bourbon is too much? And is there an alcohol? Like, can I still be at race weight and drink? Or don't tell me I can't do that. Like, can I still eat donuts? And so we have a very good relationship on life balance.
Actually, real talk, this is an important topic, especially during the pandemic year when alcohol sales have gone through the roof.
Yeah.
What is your coach Adam's take on alcohol consumption and performance?
Honestly, of course, it's a performance detriment to an extent. You know, it can dehydrate you. It can add calories. And, you know, there's all sorts of reasons, but we're kind of on the everything in moderation, including moderation. like for peace of mind, or, you know, like I don't want to limit, you know, I'm going to be smart and, you know, make wise choices, but it's probably not the best for your performance. But also being in road racing for so long and having a very restricted, orchestrated diet, like living with a team and traveling with a team all the time, like, I mean, I'm having a glass of wine before, you know, Unbound the next day or whatever. I'm not going to sit there and tell myself no.
Yeah.
So,
you know who else does that? I was talking to Kate, who is also in your neck of the woods, Kate Courtney, and she said that Nino, her teammate, Nino Schroeder, who I've lost track of how many world titles he's won, without fail, he has a glass of wine before every single important race.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of, I've had Italian team directors, I raced for Astana, and, you know, they would let me do that. They would actually give me the wine, because so he also said I was, you know, too jittery and nervous. And I was like, calma, calma, here's some wine, go to bed.
Like, so wait, sorry, you raced for Astana?
Yeah.
Whoa, what was that like culturally?
I loved it. I lived in Bergamo in Italy in a team house there with mainly I was with Alona, who's Belarusian, and then a lot of women from Kazakhstan were in my theme house. It was funny. I mean, not many of the women spoke English, so it was different. But I had a lovely time. I think it was like my, it was 2014. I think it was my favorite year racing. Because something that we do in road racing in the US, like you glorify racing in Europe and you're like, these people are tough. They're doing it for a living. And in the US, they're like, you don't know how lucky you have it. And then you go over there, and I actually really excelled at European racing because it is so hard. And the races are longer and they're just more arduous, which fits my physiology better. But the team on Astana, they were like, they loved it. They said, oh, all these girls race bikes because they have to. You race it for the passion. We love you. Like, you race it because you really want to race bikes. And so I just wanted to laugh and tell team directors that, you know, would tell you in the US, like, you know, they're harder than you because they have to do it. And I go over there and they go, we love it because you're just so happy and you love racing your bike because you do it for the passion. And I thought it was just a really beautiful to kind of let go and just go all in. And, you know, it was challenging, just the communication aspect, just not having deep conversations and real connections. We have this wonderful bond, but I mean, as I learned Italian, we're talking about the weather. What's the training today? What's for dinner? Not like deep emotional connection. But then we grew so connected as a team, and we ended up podium at the World Team Time Trial that year. So we got a bronze in Ponferrada, Spain, in the UCI World Championships. And I think that was one of my most proudest cycling achievements, is because we were kind of this ragtag team. I think out of the six riders we started with, there's five different nationalities on the team, in the team time trial. So it was super cool. Swiss, Belarusian, Italian, you know, it was pretty fun.
Is that team time trial, not that one specifically, but just team time trialing in general, do you feel like that's the most painful discipline of bike racing that you've done? Because I've heard that often. I've done a handful of team time trials collegiately for Fort Lewis and stuff, but I'd just be curious to hear your take on that.
It's so hard. Like, yeah. It's so hard. And then after, like, it makes you hate your teammates too. Like, you are just swearing up and down. Like, you swear that girl is pulling through to only like skip you because whatever. Like, you're just like, all the swear words. I won't swear on your podcast, but it's so hard. And then after that, team time trial kind of took a little like a beat as it started coming back from the world championships. And so then I'm getting hired on teams because I'm good at team time trialing. But I'm like, no, but I hate it. It's so hard. And yeah, it's 32, and I'm more of a steady rider, but I have the power. And so you're just like, just riding the whip back there.
That's the thing is at a surface level, you'd think the hardest part is when you're taking your pull on the front, but it's when you go to the back and you're hanging on for dear life after you just put your life on the line pulling, and you're just trying with every ounce of your being to not get dropped. And that reacceleration from dropping back and then getting on the wheel and getting back to, so brutal. So brutal. I still have serious flashbacks from collegiate days. And obviously that wasn't nearly the level you were doing it at, but that's cool.
That's what you say though. Your pull isn't over until you get back on.
All right. Here's a question. Would you rather race unbound and get close to the finish line? This is a total random hypothetical I'm coming up with right now. You race unbound 200 mile gravel race and you get a mile from the finish and they say, just kidding, this year it's 300 miles. You have 100 more miles to go. Would you rather do that? Or would you rather do a 100 mile team time trial flat out with your Astana team?
300 miles of gravel.
So yeah, you were meant to be a gravel racer through and through. So let's get back on topic after Adam sort of, I don't want to say derailed because he added to it, but
yeah,
we were talking about your injuries, your super gnarly crash. This was 2010, 2011, you said. But you stayed in road cycling for a while after that. When did you start making the transition to gravel and why?
So I stayed in road cycling. And then I was doing I was in a bracing for a world tour team called Silence, sponsored by Cannondale at the time. And so I was living in Spain. It was wonderful. Racing. I was meh. You know, I mean, it was great. I loved the team. But I was noticing I was showing up to races and just kind of like, oh, back racing Flanders. You know, oh, then we have to go to this race in Belgium. Oh, man, the Tour of Britain, you know, and like you're just find yourself getting this cycle, you know, with going to specific races, I guess, at the time. And I was just dreading them. Like I wasn't having fun racing anymore. I kind of had that impending doom each time you showed up. And then you realize you're like, I'm racing on the world's biggest stage. This is amazing. And I'm not loving it, but I wasn't hating it either. It just, you know, and I found out I just didn't really have any goals left in the sport that inspired me. So I was doing somebody else's goals the whole time. So I didn't want to re-sign with them, not anything against the team. I just was like, okay, I think I'm done racing. I'm just not going to do this. And they said, oh, please, please. I said, okay, I want to race Dirty Kansas. And so they're like, that is like the worst thing you could do in a road season is go leave Europe, go to Kansas and do a 200-mile gravel race. Like you're not going to recover in time. And so they actually set up the like worst schedule for me. They're like, okay, fine, you can do it, but you're going to have to do all the races you hate. Like they're gonna like you're gonna fly back and do Tour of Pila, and then you're gonna have to fly to China and do Tour of Shaanxi Island, then you're gonna do the Tour of California, and then if you still feel okay, you can do this whole like gravel thing. So I did it all, came from the Tour of California, went straight to Kansas, and then when I won that race, it was awesome, of course, but just the whole experience of the event was incredible, and I just felt like I found my people. I was like, oh, this is so nice. Like, I'm not sitting there just racing circuits around some town. I'm just a part of the community and, like, kind of found my people. Like, it doesn't matter on the results. I'd like to, you know, like, you really connect with your audience and then also your friends. And that's just kind of was amazing. So I thought, I'm hooked. I love gravel.
And what year was that?
2017.
Take us inside that first... we'll just call it Unbound, that first Unbound race. How did it play out? What was going through your head? Did you have any idea how hard it was going to be, or did you find it hard? Like how did it stack up compared to other cycling things you'd done?
So it was crazy. It was a lot harder than I expected. I had a lot of road fitness going into it. So the first 100 miles, I just stayed with the front group of guys, and it was, you know, pretty big group, but under 50 people. And so, I mean, we were going really fast. But prior to doing the event, I had never ridden over 120 miles before. And so I think that a lot of people get caught up that you have to do the distance, but it's like marathon training. I think, like, I don't think you have to run a marathon to do a marathon. So I was like, I'll be fine. I rode 120 miles once, like 4 years ago. Like, it'll be great. And I'd never ridden my bike that long either. So maybe 6 hours was the longest I've ever been on a bike. And that year, I set the course record that year, and I did it in like 11 hours and 40 minutes and 41 seconds. So that was definitely
11 hours.
40,
holy shit.
40, yeah. We were going fast.
Yeah.
Fast.
Damn.
But it was really hard. It was hot. It's long. So then I found myself for the second 100 miles very alone. Which I'm comfortable with myself enough to be alone. You know, I've got it. And I'm used to that. But it's just hot, and I've never self-navigated either. So, you know, gravel, there's not course markings. You're kind of trying to navigate using your device. I use a Lazine, and you're navigating along. And Amanda Nauman, who's won it multiple times, was, you know, coming up behind me, like just chipping away at the gap. And I'm like looking back, and I'm just straight up hallucinating. Like, in my head, like, I see stormtroopers, I see the freaking, like, Falcon. Like, I was just crazy. I lost my mind out there. I was just totally zonked. And she comes by, and she catches me, and she says, hi. I'm just like, hi? Like, I'm dying. Like, I am dying. And so we actually came into the finish together.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it gets better. So we're coming into the finish, and so DK at the time, it's 200, but ends up 200. It was 206.1 miles or something like that. And I was so nervous about, you know, we discussed that I operate on a high dose of fear and anxiety of like crashing large groups. So, as you've been to the start, it's a gnarly start. Like, you on this big road and you take a ride on gravel, everyone's lights on, and 2,000 people all think they're going to become the next gravel king or queen of the world. Like, there's 11 or 12 hours of racing remaining, and everyone is world champion on that first right turn. And so I had pre-ridden that course, just the turn at the start, because I'm like, okay, there's 2,000 people, we take a right. Okay, you know, this is where I'm going to go, this is going to be my line. And I never rode the finish, because it's 200 miles. Like, the race is over. And then here we are coming into Emporia, and you know how long you see that water tower. And we're coming into Emporia, and I'm like, is it 206.1? Is it 206 miles? Like, this makes a difference. Like, that 100 meters makes a difference. So we come up the hill into the college, and Amanda's won that, and she attacks, and I attack her, and I get a gap, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to win. This is going to be sweet. I've got it. You know, put my head down. I'm going for it.
Describe for us what those attacks look like 200 miles in, because last year Ted and I got in an attacking back and forth battle at mile 185, and I know how sadly hilarious that looked. So what did 200 miles look like?
It's funny, is Dean Golish, my coach at the time, was like, what does a sprint look like? You know, desperate molasses, you know, is like, you know, you got a camel back on, you're like, you kind of got like race gut going too. Your stomach's like kind of starting to get, I don't know if that happens to you, but for me, it's like,
definitely.
And like, stomach, you're cramping. Like, I'm fully cramping. Like, I was cramping. I did, and she'd look back and be like, you know, like, I'm not crampy. I'm like, it's like trying to breathe. No, it's pathetic. Like, it's like, you're just, that's like what I was using in my head. I was giving myself my own sound effects. I'm like, roar. You know, I attacked her back, because that's what you do, right? You know, you got to counter. And so I get the gap, and I'm like, okay, this is going to be amazing. And I go past the university, and I look back, and Amanda has this just look of like, and she just takes a left. Like, I missed the turn.
Oh my God.
So I have to flip it, come back, and I catch her in the finishing chute and have to sprint again.
No way. And you went by her?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. What was that post-race conversation like? Like, how absolutely crestfallen was she?
She's such a good, like, true champion. You know, she's great. I think, you know, I think, like, at one point, you know, you always want to win. But I think it's not the pinnacle point of gravel too. So, and she'd won it a few times. I think she was pretty crestfallen, but also having, I think in the time that I had attacked her and then had the gap, like, she had already lost the race in the moment.
Right. Yeah.
And so I kind of had that in my head as my psychology. I go, okay, she's already lost. All I got to do is get a wheel in front of her and, like, I can do it again. And it was just a pretty fun moment in my career, like, horrible, but it was like, the first time I probably truly tried to sprint, which it probably wasn't even a sprint, obviously. It was like a 400-watt sprint.
Yeah.
No snap left in the legs there.
And so when you took the wrong turn and you knew you were super, super close to the finish and you had to turn around and ride back to her, like, there was not even a half a second where you thought, man, I really screwed that up. Shoot, I'll try again next year. You just stayed locked in and were like, it's not over.
It was probably one of the most unique parts of my career. And Dean at the time, who also was coaching Rebecca Rush, he works with Red Bull now. He's amazing. But he was like, why did it take a 200-mile gravel race to bring out something I always knew you had? But I had the rage of a god in me. Like, when I missed that turn, I was just like, swear word. No effing way did I just do that. I will get back. I will win. And like... No, like, Amanda was great, and I like just like cataloged her like she was just like this thing I had to beat, and like, and I'm like going, and you know those cones, they are not meant to sprint, like it's like a marathon finish,
super narrow.
There's not, and I at this point I'm like, I don't care, I'm gonna hit the cones, I'm gonna hit the stairs, like, and that's what Dean's like, why didn't you ever have that sense of desperation and rage like on the road, like. You needed that to win more races. Where was that? I'm like, who knew? He's like, 200 miles. And I got exactly what I knew you had in you out of you. So.
Interesting. How did your life change after winning Unbound?
It sounds really lame to say, not lame, I guess, but it really did change. It was probably one of the biggest career pivot points that I've ever had. It gave me exposure to a broader audience. It brought us part of the sport that I really enjoy and love. And also it was at the crux of gravel racing increasing and events and this whole side of the industry. So to be kind of on the forefront of that and be able to get involved with other brand partners and then be able to kind of just keep doing what I love on my own terms and not racing road anymore. And to give me, it really gave me a voice, I think. And so I hope to do something to have an impact now and for good, you know, like getting more people on bikes in a healthy way, getting them off road into the adventure. And it's not really about the race, but it's about loving the bike. So it really did change quite a bit.
Yeah. Let's talk about how you've sort of leaned on that some this year during the pandemic year. Because even though you and I have made the decision not to race, like a handful of our peers, most of our peers have decided to, you know, set the example of not competing this year and going to mass participation events. You've stayed really busy, stayed engaged, continued to use your platform. What was it like figuring out how to do that in this really unusual year? And then how have you gone about doing it?
Yeah, I think it's a natural part of my personality. I'm a storyteller and I like to engage with people. So I don't find what I do on social media forced or like I have to. I think I've done that my whole career. And as social media has changed, we're losing our content from the events, but I think we still want to engage with our community. So, you know, you can do that via social media, of course. And you know, the cycling industry didn't stop during this pandemic. You know, bike sales are through the roof. So there's ways that we can still like kind of bring some bike stoke to people, you know, whether it's new trails, exploring your backyard. So that part's like the easy part, and it's the fun part too. Because you know, what we're doing is real. Like, you're out doing the Colorado Trail. I'm out eating oysters and drinking Sancerre.
It's the same. It's the same thing.
Yeah. So I think that part's easy because we built the community and our community wants us, we want to engage with them. And I want to talk to them and see how everyone's doing, check in too on the mental health side of things, still get out on the bikes, you know, go do something really crazy like the Colorado Trail or don't, and, you know, still you're okay and you're enough. You know, it's been a crazy freaking year.
Yeah. Talk to me about the bandanas you put together with Sturmy.
Yeah. Sarah Sturm. I'm so excited. It took me a bit in the pandemic, you know, like everyone's like, oh, I'm going to write a book or you're in Everest or I'm like, I don't want to do anything. You know, like I'm just going to keep working and riding my bike. And then I had this crazy idea, like, and it's not about face coverings, although I do ride with a bandana quite frequently because of gravel. And now I can use it to go into my local bakery or something when I'm out riding. But I like bandanas for my little cowgirl style. And I think they're a cool bike accessory for a lot of practical reasons and fashion. And so Sturmy.
Fashion.
Yeah, cowgirl fashion. And Sturmy has, she opened up her design, like she is also creative. And so she developed her, she's a designer and she's a specialized teammate of mine. And she lives in your neck of the woods in Durango and she's so rad. And so I asked her if she would be interested in collaborating and I could hire her to do some design work. So she came up with 3 designs. I printed them out and I got a bunch of bandanas and then I'm doing the proceeds of the bandanas are going to doing scholarships to bring more women and diversity into the sport. The first set of 2 scholarships are going to NorCal Mountain Bike League, which is a part of NYCA, but it's this kind of whole NorCal league or NYCA up here. So then I can hopefully be able to mentor or ride with the riders, or maybe they can teach me a thing or two about mountain biking.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's super cool. And it's been really rewarding. It's going great. So people are rocking some bandanas and we're already have one scholarship, enough for one scholarship. And now I'm working on the next one. So
where can people check those out? The bandanas?
Yeah, I have a website and the link is in my profile on Instagram. So I'm at amtetrick on Instagram. And so the link is in my profile there or on Facebook or however else. Yeah.
Nice. So you're sort of downplaying the adventure side of cycling. You're like, yeah, you can do the Colorado Trail or not, but I know better. You definitely like partaking in that sort of thing now and then. And a little bird told me about this crazy trip you took to Kyrgyzstan at one point. Can we talk about that briefly before we wrap this thing? Because yeah. I don't know that much about it. I know that it happened, but that's about it.
Yeah, so I got a call from Specialized and they asked, like, you want to do a trip of a lifetime? He's kind of like, that's big, but sure. And they're
like, that's big, but sure.
Yeah. Next week, they're like, you want to go to Kyrgyzstan and go bikepacking the Silk Road?
Wait, they said next week?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So I was like, all right. And yeah, I have a day job, so I'm going, okay, what do you need to go to Kyrgyzstan? You know, and it's bikepacking. And they said, what do you need? And I was like, everything. They're like, okay, so we'll like get you the packs. What else? I'm like, no, everything. I don't camp. Like, I need a sleeping bag, a tent. Like, I need everything. And so they're like, okay, we'll bring it to Kyrgyzstan, see you there. And I go, what do I need to bring? And they're like, get a spork and a like a mug.
What do I need for Kyrgyzstan? Well, we have everything. Bring a spork.
I remember the Pusher and the Crusher at the time. I'm driving with, I'm being driven. And I'm like on Amazon buying a spork. And I'm like, I'll get a real fancy one, like a titanium. Got some like freeze dried food. And we went and bike packing. And I never set up a tent before. Never camped really.
Who was this with? Who did you do this with besides Specialized? Who were the actual individuals involved?
Cycling tips. So Andy, who started that whole Everstein thing of cycling tips, he was there. And then it was Specialized Australia. So Matilda was there. And then a couple others from a group called Cirque Cycling that specialize in Asia tours, Asia bike tours. They're super cool. It was a little group of about six of us.
Yeah, what happened? I mean, what was the actual trip like? What did you do? How far did you go? What did you learn? Did you use your spork?
I used my spork, ate freeze-dried food. I had the most amazing time. It was seriously the most beautiful place I'd ever been. It was like being in Colorado to being in the Alps to being in the Grand Canyon. Like, the amount of relief in different environments were insane. It's very untouched to this point still. The reason of the trip was to be able to see it in its untouched glory. It's one of the most remote places in the world, also the most landlocked. And China is putting in a big, like, you know, $1 trillion like freeway for trade to go through it. So I think the whole point of the trip was to be able to experience it in its untouched, beautiful state. It was incredible. I think what I learned most was, also similar to my 2014 experience on Astana, is just in another way, was to let go and to really be present and enjoy where I was and not worry about training, be nervous about racing or being, like, just really be present. And it took me, it sounds like first world problems, but it took me a little longer than I want to admit to get to that, like, let go of some of that angst of what I should be doing and really enjoy it. So several days in probably, and then finally I was like, okay, you know, embrace this uncomfortableness. And we were doing, I think the longest was only probably about 110K, that, you know, maybe 100, maybe 70 miles our longest day, but your bikes are really heavy. So that took like 7 hours or something. Like, it took a long time. But to let go and let go of just your control and to really be present. And that's harder for me than most people probably, but I think it's hard for a lot of us just to kind of let go. And I think that's when you kind of find that flow and that nice perfect Zen moment. So it wasn't as hard physically. I don't think it was that hard, but because, you know, we trained for this, but I think it was hard mentally for a bit. And it just was a stunning experience. Also, what made it really challenging was most of it. I think we spent probably 9 consecutive days above 9,000 feet. You know, it's real high. Yeah. If you're used to that, but I'm not great at altitude. So, and we were summiting we summited like a 14,000 foot peak, which wasn't even the halt, like it was the only one on the road over it. And, you know, we're walking our bikes. It's so steep. It's rocky, you know, hard to breathe.
Do you have any other bike packing or really big multi-day rides like that that you have interest in checking off the bucket list at some point?
Yeah, I would like to do some in, you know, out of Bishop or, you know, kind of over there, Eastern Sierras, go out in some of those fire roads. I think there's could be some kind of like, Yuri's done some of them, but a nice ghost town tour type of a thing, you know, and out there, but wait till it's warmer. I don't want to do it in the cold.
Yeah.
I think that'd be super fun. I would love to do something in South America, like Argentina. I think that'd be super cool.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah.
So much to explore.
Yeah, it was stunning. If anyone wants to go and check out that Silk Road, like by all means, like once traveled and everything's safe, it is a trip of a lifetime. I can't even describe it's incredible.
Speaking, let's maybe just kind of end on that note, or at least start tying it up in regards to travel, in regards to getting back to some sort of level of normalcy, quote unquote, whatever that looks like on the other side of all this. What is your perspectives about your job as a leader or ambassador right now? What are your perspectives in regards to travel, in regards to going to events that have a lot of people out there? What's sort of your, because I'm sure you've spent a lot of time thinking about it, because it puts folks like us in a trickier position. Where do you sit on all that right now?
I'm not trying to just steal your idea of it, but you had posted something about it on social media. And it really just kind of struck a chord where you were talking about setting a good example. And I hadn't thought about it that way until you said that. And that's where I'm going to take my stand too, is I think we want to set a positive and good example for people. And so I want to do what's the safest, you know, most cautious approach. Because not only I'm not worried as much about my health, but it's also health of others. So if I'm traveling to an event with a mass start of people, like I'm making an impact and a footprint everywhere I go, whether it's in gas stations along the way or in airports, I don't know if that's the right thing for me to do. So I want to be socially responsible and to help promote our overall health. I don't think it's a political issue or anything, you know, I don't think it should be divisive. Everyone's free to make their own choice. And that is my responsibility, though, I think, is to set a good example, maintain health for others. And, you know, I go to events and I can't see my, you know, my mom for a couple of weeks after. You know, that's really selfish of me, I think. And also then if I wanted to see her, it'd be selfish of me to see her too soon, you know. So I don't think it's about races and results. I think it's like promoting overall health. And I think we can do that from afar from right now.
For sure. It's good to hear you say that. I mean, it is a tough conversation, and you and I are in a better position to maintain our relationships maintain our careers without racing. So it's a little bit easier for us to say, I think, in some regards. But yeah, I appreciate you prioritizing that, because it is obviously a very historic moment. And my thing is, I just want to be on the right side of history. Who knows how we're going to look back on this time 20, 30, 45 years from now, but I'd rather err on the side of safety at this point, I think.
Yeah.
What else? Does anything else come to mind? Was there anything else you wanted to talk about? I didn't really give you the chance to, you know, chat beforehand and say, oh, this is something I'd really value being able to discuss. We just sort of shot from the hip, which is our style anyway.
No, I actually just one thing, we've talked about being fortunate to be, you know, where we are in our sport, and the, you know, I think with that comes responsibility, of course, but reasons for that. Like I just, when people look to aspire to be a cyclist or a professional athlete, even, I always like to encourage education first and foremost, and always investing in yourself, like on and off the bike, because, you know, that helps me when I'm down in the dumps about an event that I failed at, or, you know, you aren't worried about your social media followers because you're being authentic to you, but you also are so much more. And I always think education, like I take my education really like seriously. And being able to do more than just bikes is always something that like just helps me separate, you know, like performance on the bike, on social media, on like brand management to like, oh no, I also can do this trade or this other thing. So.
No, it's a really, really good point. I mean, not to mention the whole conversation of what comes after bikes.
Yeah.
I think it's so easy, especially young riders who have a lot of promise, who have a lot of positive affirmation, you know, they have parents, coaches, competitors, you know, this social media world just yelling at them how talented they are, how gifted they are, how they should, you know, pour everything they have into this sport and getting to the highest level that they can get. But the truth is life is so unpredictable. It takes one serious crash like you had. It takes, you know, one huge or multiple huge screw ups on social media, whatever it is, to derail all of your eggs being in one basket. And even if something significant like that doesn't happen, just day to day, I can't imagine going through life where you are 100% hyper-focused on a single thing. And so you spend whatever it is, 3 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours a day focused on being really good at that one thing. And then once it's over with, you continue thinking about that one thing, even when you're not doing it and fixating over it. You've mentioned, you know, mental health a lot during this conversation. And from that standpoint, I just don't understand how that would be sustainable doing it that way. So I appreciate you saying that. When you say education, do you mean more like formal education or ongoing, you know, day to day staying informed? What do you mean?
Good. Yeah, I think probably both. I mean, I do always encourage going to college. I got my graduate degree while racing. I also think it's about ongoing growth and educating yourself, like just keep growing and learning. That's something that's important. And that's why I usually invest in yourself sort of way, like loosely, but just keep growing that way. And I always like, I agree with you. Like sometimes I know you probably wake up to like, why did I ever do this podcast? I'm like, I have to do this podcast, this post, I have to do this, I have to do that. And then you look and, you know, so-and-so is training X amount of hours and, you know, talking about their FTP or something, God forbid. And like, that can be really stressful. Like for me too, I'm like, why do I have a day job? Why do I like, like I have to fit in like my rides in between all these conference calls and, you know, all this stuff. And I could be such a better cyclist if I could just ride my bike. And it turns out like, it doesn't make me happy, you know, to do that. Even though I think I do always excel maybe with a little, being a little busier, juggling a lot of different things, but it can be stressful, right? Like where you don't feel like you're enough. Like I won't feel like I'm enough on the bike. I don't feel like I'm enough off the bike. And I get that kind of horrible feeling that you're just not good enough at anything. You're like, I'm marginal at best at everything. but you know, to keep working, pushing forward and to then also hone in on what's important to you, what are your priorities and what do you want to focus on.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, it's a really important point. I'm glad you brought that up. What else? Anything? What else are you doing today?
I have a call here in a little bit, in 15 minutes, work call. Probably going to try to spin because it's like 80 degrees and clear and not windy out. Going to try to get out for like an hour, but maybe like noon, and plug away. I just wrote a press release for this biotech company. I do that stuff. So going to probably hit send, even though it's a really bad news cycle. I told them they should probably not be sending out press releases the day before the election, but you know.
Seriously.
They won't listen to this podcast. So yeah, I'm gonna write about some medical devices. And got quite a bit of work to do. Yeah. A lot of book.
Nice. Gotta call back Adam Pulford, don't forget.
I know. The last text I got from him last night was a bottle of wine he got, and he was sending me pictures of his wine and pizza.
What a great coach. Yeah. Very nice. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Allie. I'm glad we finally got to do this. Keep up the good work. I can't wait to see what you keep churning out. Yeah. Hopefully we'll see each other in person at some point soon.
Yeah, when we can, that'd be great. I just really enjoy like what you bring to the sport, all the hard work you do. You're definitely a very bright light in a kind of a vague, cloudy world these days. So I want you to have confidence in what you're doing too. And I love to see your happiness and, you know, hard work ethic. So thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate that so much. I know a lot of people feel the same way about you. So keep up the good work.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Be in touch.
Great. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you all for listening. And thank you to Zwift for being presenting partner of the show. Earlier, I was talking about sort of the less structured ways that Zwift is really an asset for your riding and can be really fun and interactive and make riding inside such an enjoyable thing these days. But they do provide more structured ways to enjoy Zwift as well. There are all kinds of training plan options just at any point on Zwift. So if you want to do a functional threshold power test, for example, they can guide you through that. If you want to do a Zwift race, there are constantly Zwift races happening each and every day. I can assure you they are very, very hard. Luckily, there's different levels. There's A races, B races, C races, etc. And right now, they also have the Zwift Academy. The Zwift Academy started in October. It's running right through November. And it's this really awesome program that involves group training sessions, group rides, guided training sessions with real coaches, and both men's and women's options. So if you go to Zwift.com/ZA Road Men's, you can sign up for the men's, or /ZA Road Women's to sign up for the women's Zwift Academy. And just as an extra little carrot, a little cherry on top, if you're an extra super overachiever, this is a proving ground. Zwift Academy is a proving ground. So the top performers in Zwift Academy, both male and female, have a chance at a pro contract. On the men's side with Alpecin Phoenix, that's Matthew Vanderpool's team, and on the women's side, Canyon SRAM, one of the most successful women's world tour teams. So if you fancy yourself a super high achiever, that's an extra little carrot to chase. Just go to Zwift.com, and regardless of what your goals are, whether you want to chase that pro contract, whether you want to enroll in Zwift Academy, or whether you want to just go ride for fun and tank your recovery spins by chasing KOMs, all of those things are options. Go check it out. Also, this episode was brought to you by Zip. I'd like to thank Zip for A, being such great supporters of the Orange Seal Off-Road team, the team I ride for, but also longstanding supporters of the Adventure Stash. I'm about to go for a little evening spin on my Zip 303S wheels, which have completely changed the way I ride drop bar bikes, whether it's my gravel bike, whether it's my road bike. They've made setting up tubeless tires, whether it's road tubeless or gravel tubeless, a lot easier. One of the main differences here, one of the main technological advancements, is the hookless rim. This is super key for a bunch of reasons. One, it makes it really easy to get tires on and off. I literally don't have to use tire levers. I can just do it with my hands. And it also creates a really nice, seamless interface between the rim and the tire, which makes it some of the most aerodynamic rims in the world. These are super, super fast wheels. Also, it allows for less material, less resin use. So when they're doing the actual carbon layup, they're able to save materials and make it lighter. So not only is this wheel faster, but it's also lighter. And because they can use fewer materials and it's just a better process, better manufacture process, it's cheaper. So you really win on all fronts. And this has just been my go-to wheel for every drop bar bike, regardless of whether it's a race, whether I'm chasing some Strava record, whatever it is, or just training. I've literally ridden these on single track on my gravel bike and smoked them on square edge rocks when I don't take the sweetest line, and they haven't complained at all. I absolutely love this wheel, and you can go check it out at zip.com. Zip is all about making you faster. They've made me faster, and I know they'll make you faster too. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing this show each and every week. We have some really exciting guests coming up, y'all. Obviously, we always have lots of bike riders on this show, but we have some non-bike riders coming up, some folks that are, how shall we say, real-world heroes, folks that are keeping us safe, folks that really don't get enough shine. You know, athletes, high-achieving athletes tend to have big Instagram followings and have articles written about them and put out cool videos and stand on top of podiums, but there are other heroes out there that don't get that opportunity, and a lot of them don't want it. Their motivations are different sometimes, but they are every bit as tough, every bit as gritty, and honestly, jobs far more important. And I'm really looking forward to giving some of those folks some well-deserved shine and really learning about their world too. So stay tuned. That's coming in the coming weeks. Thanks for listening.